tonight on Arena. Yes, I'm going to get there eventually. Well, do you know what I'll tell you? I'll just tell you that Junior Brother's sitting in front of me and that he's going to play some music live. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the program at RTE Arena. And you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. And indeed, if you were watching just a second ago, you'll have seen me panic. That's the joy of live radio. It all comes on top of you all of a sudden. Hailing from County Kerry, Junior Brother is a singer-songwriter who many would agree is redefining modern Irish folk in some ways. His debut, Pull the Right Rope, claimed the Choice Music Prize nomination for Irish Album of the Year in 2019. His 2022 follow-up, The Great Irish Famine, earned him an Album of the Year nomination from the RTE Folk Awards. His new album, The End, will be released in September. It touches on the folklore of fairy forts, but does it in a way that tackles the chaos of the modern world at the same time. The plight of nature, the rise of the far right and mortality are all important themes on the album, which blends traditional Irish instruments with more otherworldly sounds. And delighted that, as I say, Ronan Keeley, or Junior Brother, is sitting in front of me this evening and is going to perform for us. But tell us about all of this research that you had been doing into fairy forts and all of this side of our tradition, which was via the UCD Folklore Collection, I believe, Ronan.
Yeah. Basically, it was, I suppose, what is it, 5 years ago now, when I was in lockdown, quarantine down home in Kilcommon, Kerry, where I'm from. I just had lots of time to wander around there. I ended up going, like lots of people did, on big walks, and I ended up kind of just getting a little bit obsessed with these banks of earth I kept seeing in the landscape, and just started reading into ring forts then, and got kind of a little bit obsessed with it. It was my like lockdown obsession, and I just fell in love with the landscape kind of where I'm from, which I always wrote about, but being based in Dublin, it was more an imaginary version of it. Then I was forced to confront it, and I actually got into local mythology, things like that, but mainly, features in the landscape, such as ring forts and just...
And this is in and around your home in Kerry?
Yeah, and then I got really into that, and then just started writing what would become the next album, and it just kind of started trying to see if I could mix sort of actual first-hand accounts that I was hearing and reading
in this folklore collection, yeah,
and just seeing if I could kind of draw parallels with kind of what was going on at the time, and just the madness of how things felt and the madness of how things kind of still feel as well, and just drawing parallels between one thing and the other.
Yeah, I was looking earlier on today what's the name of the song on the album about the mountain?
Welcome to my mountain.
And you're in the video, and it's you up on this mountain. There's a ring fort. There's a pure fella watching you. Mm-hmm. And you see this idea of the character within the film is kind of a little bit driven mad in some ways by this particular fairy fort. I mean, had you that kind of feeling around looking at these things? I know lockdown was a time when a lot of us, it was hard to hold on to reality in many ways. But had you a sense of this otherworldliness in these little spaces that maybe you had walked past before and not noticed so much?
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely in my mind. And also, that side of things inspired the music in itself. In that, you know, the stories of like hearing otherworldly kind of music that is Irish traditional music, but is unlike anything the listener has ever heard. I was just kind of saying to myself, why don't I give that a crack?
Yeah, and on the album, there are lots of instrumentation in there. Obviously, it's just you, your guitar, and I see a tambourine down there beside your foot as well.
Yep.
So you'll be recreating some of those sounds via those two instruments tonight. You're going to sing the song Small Violence, and this really does, it feels like a fella who's on some kind of trip around this fairy fort, but it starts to sing and to deal very much with contemporary realities.
Yeah, it's influenced by kind of misinformation online, while also being influenced by sort of marginally that kind of feeling maybe of being lost in the mythological sense in a ring fort or in some sort of energy, sort of force field.
Yeah, yeah. You get that sense, as you know, the opening lyrics, here am I doubled up, doubled over, curled up on the ground. So he's not in a good state, this fella, as he's singing the song. Let's hear it. Small Violence.
Thank you.
That is Junior Brother with his song Small Violence from his upcoming album, The End. And I realised the minute you start singing that, I had quoted the wrong lyrics. I went alone toward a heavy light is how Small Violence opens. I saw a massive head, I saw a little crown, I saw a snake of many colours. Clearly the man in question is not in a good state. I got a sense of it there. I mean, and people who have heard, because that single has been released previous to this, you know, even that chromatic scale that you do at the beginning, that's kind of slightly off kilter, but you're still feeding into the Irish traditional, or the sounds of traditional Irish music. How much is that in your background as much as the kind of the more contemporary stuff, Roland?
It's just something else that I just got interested in with everything else, really. It was in bits in my childhood, all right. I wouldn't have said I was surrounded by it at all. It's more something that was just there, kind of always, wasn't too close to it. It was only kind of when I moved to Dublin about 8 years ago and kind of got into the scene here. There's just such a vibrant trad scene in Dublin. That was when I really kind of started playing sessions and really getting into playing different trad instruments and things like that. And that's how it really started feeding into the music. And then when I moved back home then for those couple of months, I just kind of used all that in a more focused way in terms of my own stuff.
Another thing that comes across on some of the tracks in the album is you are musing about mortality. Now, it will come to us all eventually, the end of life. What does you in that particular spot, do you think? Hopefully a longer way away for you than it is for me, certainly, and hopefully a long way away for both of us. But, you know, you're a relatively young man.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just it's something that'd be in the back of your mind, and songwriting, a lot of it's subconscious, so you're plumbing from the back of your mind a lot. That's where that is, I guess. I wouldn't be going on about it in my day-to-day life or whatever, you know.
And I guess a song allows you to do that. It just you mightn't even know why it's bubbling up, but it's bubbling, and the song just allows you. Does it take a kind of a bravery to just run with that and not judge the nature of the theme, not judge the nature of the thought?
Yeah, and it's a way of just dealing with it as well, in a way that you understand. The only kind of thing I understand is writing songs, really. So that way, something that I don't, that confuses me or is a bit frightening, if you filter it through something you understand, you can maybe see it a bit clearer, maybe.
Yeah.
Or at least get a bit of catharsis.
Yeah. A little bit of understanding around it in some way. A Lot of Love is the second song that you're going to perform for us. This is the first, certainly the first radio performance of this song. You may have tried it out on various gigs along the way. A little bit about what was in the head as you were heading towards this, apart from it was bubbling away in your subconscious. Was there other things at play?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, actually, like the album was all done chronologically. So I literally started demoing, writing and arranging it from the start of the first song on the album all the way to the end. So it kind of marks that period chronologically when I wrote it. So it was in the middle of lockdown coming out of it. So that's kind of what the album is. And that's why the album's called The End, because it's about the end of a period.
Yeah, rather than
madness.
The end.
Yeah, exactly.
Full stop. This, it's all over.
It's a starting point nearly, you know.
Ah, yeah.
And so this song was written directly after I finished that song I just performed, Small Violence. It comes after it on the album. So literally, the start of this song, I wrote it from listening to the end of Small Violence.
All right. So
the album has that kind of a flow to
so
it.
So literally, the end of one song brought you into the beginning.
Exactly.
Another.
Yeah. And this song, I had it floating around for a little while with different lyrics. And then I just changed the lyrics to it and it fit. So.
All right. Well, let's hear it then. A Lot of Love from Junior Brother, or Ronan Keeley. But Junior Brother is the performing name.
And the song is out tomorrow as well. There's no reason and things people
people say, good people come and then go away. The devil whispered to me good night, like a ceasefire without a fight. I jump into low lover's arms where the pain is real, I feel no harm. They're doing nothing wrong, they're doing nothing good.
Keely, our junior brother, with his latest single, A Lot of Love, out this very night. Is it midnight tonight, Ronan? Yeah?
Yes, and the video is out at noon tomorrow.
Midnight tonight for the song, noon tomorrow for the video, and I believe it stars you, leading role in that video. That's Ronan Keely, junior brother, the new single, A Lot of Love, midnight tonight. The new album will be available in September, and Junior Brother's Irish tour kicks off on September the 12th in Cork. There'll be gigs in Dublin, Drogheda, Tralee, Clonakilty, Galway, Limerick and Dundalk, and you can find out full details on Ronan's website, which is juniorbrother.com. Well, sad news just reaching us that Ozzy Osbourne has passed away at the age of 76. I see the television screens in front of me here in studio, absolutely full of that breaking news. The family says Osbourne died surrounded by love. Was the little ticker tape going along the bottom as I was looking up there. Joining me is John Kenny to speak about Ozzy Osbourne. We have to think about Black Sabbath, but Ozzy Osbourne, John, what did he do in terms of music and in terms of heavy metal music, I suppose, really?
Yeah, well, Black Sabbath, as you mentioned there, was obviously the first band that he set up. It was 1970, 69, 70, that kind of time. And a lot of those hits people still talk about. In fact, when I was doing the metal show on 2FM, one of the separators we used was a piece of Paranoid by Black Sabbath. So, yeah everybody knew him. He was fired from the band, obviously, in 1979 for, well, that's put it down as a misuse of alcohol and other substances. But they didn't end his career there, because he went off and he sold like 100 million albums, the Blizzard of Oz, his solo work as well, 13 albums solo work. Being fired from Black Sabbath didn't kill his career by any stretch of the imagination, which was amazing.
That solo work, and I suppose lots of people know him in more recent times for the reality TV work, but that solo work, just sticking with what he achieved musically, what did he do there that perhaps, I'm sure there were creative differences quoted at the time too with Black Sabbath, but what did he do as an artist and as a musical artist that makes him stand out from the crowd, or that made him stand out for the crowd from you?
Yeah, I just think he just kind of kept that simple way about him, and he just had a kind of personality that people could warm to, and that's what I thought big time about Ozzy. And musically, his stuff was really good. Like over the last couple of years, he did stuff. A lot of people who are getting older in the business do collaboration works as well, and his collaboration works was really good. Even stuff like with Elton John, which was a bit mad.
Yeah, you wouldn't necessarily put the two of them together.
You certainly wouldn't, no. But, I mean, obviously, look, you put your musical differences aside as you get older and you get hopefully a bit wiser, I think. But and obviously he did that farewell concert there in the last couple of weeks in Birmingham, so which is a bit prophetic as well. So
was there a sense? I mean, it was at Villa Park just a fortnight ago, I think, as you say, in his hometown of Birmingham. Was there a sense? Was there a real knowledge at this at that time that this is it? This is my last goodbye.
Well, I think it's everybody surprised he actually got as far as 76, to be quite honest. But you could see him, like he was a larger-than-life character, as you mentioned there, about doing the Osbournes and having that reality television programme. Brought him back into the thing again as well. And then they reformed Black Sabbath and just went on the road. And obviously, he couldn't do a lot because he was getting into ill health over the last couple of years. But I think, obviously, from the family's point of view and the fans' point of view, to pack out Villa Park like he did a couple of weeks ago, very fitting, I think, hurrah and goodbye from Ozzy Osbourne.
We'll finish up with Paranoid. How important is this in terms of Ozzy Osbourne, in terms of his career and what he did, John?
Well, as I said, it was a little stinger for me for 6.5 years or 7 years on the Metal Show on 2FM, so it was never going to leave my mind, I can tell you. And you can still play it today in a function or whatever, and people, even who weren't anywhere near that age, will still know this song. It's an amazing piece of music. It's very short, very snappy, as you're going to hear in a few minutes' time, but it just, I think, encapsulates everything that Ozzy Osbourne was and Black Sabbath were themselves.
Thanks very much for joining us for that. That's John Kenny speaking of Ozzy Osbourne, whose death has been announced. He was 76, and here is Paranoid. Hard to believe, in fact, that it was at about this time, almost 12 months ago to this very day, in fact, the 26th of July, that we announced the death of Sinead O'Connor here on Arena. This Saturday, as I said, July the 26th, marks the second anniversary of her passing. A new collection of essays celebrates Sinead O'Connor's career, her vision and her legacy. It's called Nothing Compares to Sinead, Nothing Compares to You, What Sinead O'Connor Means to Us. And it is edited by Martha Baines and Sonia Huber. Delighted that Martha is joining us now to discuss the collection, along with one of the contributors to the collection of essays, our own Sinead Gleeson. You're both very welcome to the programme. She's singing again about her own life, Nico Case observes in this collection's foreword, and she does not apologise. I guess, Martha, that must have been one of the joys for yourself and Sonia as you went through the way you've laid out this book, which is an essay with each person attaching the essay to a particular song. But every song, in many ways, is just about who she was and what she believed.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the program, by the way.
Not at all.
I'm really, really thrilled to be here. I think that what connected Sinead to so many listeners, especially with those first couple of albums, was that she was mining a lot of really intense personal material with a sort of emotional clarity and honesty that felt really revolutionary at the time.
Go ahead.
And I think that people responded to that. And I think that a lot of the contributors to our book, who are mostly coming from a world of essayists and memoirists, in large part, and journalists, who are really kind of attracted to that honesty.
And again, let me bring in Sinead Gleeson at this very point. I think Martha has said it very well there, Sinead. It was that honesty that really, for so many people, that was what attracted them to Sinead O'Connor. And you have to remember the Ireland that she, which is what your essay does, it remembers the Ireland in which she grew up and the Ireland in which she became an artist, and how that context is hugely important in terms of understanding her and how hard it was to just stand up and tell the truth like she did.
Absolutely, Sean. I mean, you can't talk about Sinead, placing Sinead in the context of Irish cultural and social life. This was a country that was, you know, under the glove of the Catholic Church, a country of silences, a country that had very specific ideas of what a woman and a mother and an artist, and Sinead was all three of those things, what that kind of person could be, and was very good at telling people what they should and shouldn't be. And again, when you've got somebody like Sinead who didn't really care what people thought and thought it was more important to be direct and be a truth teller and speak truth to power, often, as we know, at great personal cost and at commercial cost, cost to her career. But I think she, a lot of us, and myself included, when I was growing up and looking at her and looking around me at all the things that weren't being said and weren't allowed to be said or were censured, you had this small, hairless woman who was just saying all of the things. And I think I say in my essay that for a lot of Irish women, we were waiting a long time for someone like Sinead to come along. And there she was.
And even, as you said, the small hairless woman, even that choice of hairstyle in itself was a statement, in any ways, I would argue, to the record industry. I'll be who I am. I'm not going to look the way you want me to look. I look the way I want me to look. That claiming of her body and of her image was hugely important.
Absolutely. I mean, the irony, I mean, if they had wanted to dress her up like any other contemporary pop star, she would have just blended in. But this kind of Amazonian warrior-like figure of her, and of course she was incredibly beautiful as well, but it was very much, and a lot of the material in the songs is about those kind of battles with the record company, who had ideas about femininity, about her music, about that you could write songs about this, but Sinead was writing songs about abortion and Margaret Thatcher and about the world and about Ireland and the secrecy that went on in the name of religion in this country. So there's a lot of things that had her at odds with the record company and the wider world, but I'm the only Irish writer in the book, and it felt very important to me, if a global or American audience were reading this book, that they would know that context of Sinead, that everyone else was probably looking at the music and the, you know, fighting with Frank Sinatra or whatever it is. But I wanted to talk about what she meant to us in Ireland and her importance as a kind of political figure and an activist figure as well as a singer.
And it struck me, Martha, Sinead talking there about how important it was for her to put that Irish context around Sinead O'Connor. But it did strike me how personal, in fact, so many of the essays are in their response to both Sinead O'Connor, the person and the artist, but the fact that yourself and Sonia, your co-editor, allowed people, now I can only imagine the debates there were about this, you allowed them to choose a song? Did you did you give them shortlists of songs? Did you?
Nope, it was
wide open.
It was wide open. What we asked people to, which the assignment was specifically to pick a song and attach it to something important in your life, to a moment of revelation or challenge, transformation. So that really was the brief. But you could pick any song from any part of her career. It could be a cover. And, you know, I think we really got there. I think the book skews a little heavily towards her early career, but there's some really amazing deep cuts in there as well. So I'm really pleased with the range.
Sinead Gleeson, did you have to think twice about Mandinka, or was it just there from the very start?
No, not at all. And I guess, you know, there's a lot of Sinead songs I could write about. But for me, that is the first video I remember seeing on Super Channel or whatever it was. And then there she is in the boots and the jacket and the, you know, the light is glinting off the guitar's body. And she's literally like swaying and swirling around the place and confident, it seemed to me. And just that line of that, I do know Mandinka, it felt like a confession. And there's so much emotion in it. I'd never seen anything like it. I thought, who the hell is this? So it was kind of very much tied to that time in my life. And I think, again, a lot of the stuff that went on, that was going on in Ireland, that Sinead was getting involved in, was stuff that I was interested in, that was making me think about the world and politics and activism. And there she was doing it all and showing us all how to do it. So yeah, I was delighted I got to write about Mandinka. It's such an incredible song. And as I say in the piece, you know, and I didn't necessarily know what a Mandinka was, but I kind of got what she was saying, you know?
The song Mandinka, of course, from Sinead O'Connor, and that's the choice of Sinead Gleeson in the collection of essays that we're speaking about this evening here in Arena. Nothing Compares to You, What Sinead O'Connor Means to Us. And Sinead Gleeson, as I said, with us, as is Martha Bain, co-editor with Sonia Huber of this collection of essays. It's interesting too, Sinead, you know, you gave us the context of the Ireland that Sinead O'Connor came out of. But anybody who remembers that time will remember the series Roots on television and the Alex, I think she mentions this in her memoir, doesn't she? The Alex Haley's novel and that idea of Mandinka.
Yeah, which was a kind of an African tribe that she felt an affinity with. And again, you know, Sinead wouldn't have realised her privilege as, you know, a South County Dublin white woman realising that that's what she felt. But I know what she felt. She felt that sense of isolation and outsiderness and injustice for all of the things that were collectively happening in Ireland. And even, you know, she talks about the Dance of the Seven Veils at the start of the song, which is a dig at the record company, you know, which is Salome's mother thinking she was wasting her talent. So you could, she crammed an awful lot of like cultural political references into that song as well, that as that, that those lines about feeling no pain and feeling no shame, which felt very groundbreaking and very kind of courageous to me to stand up and say that at a time when it was very hard for Sinead to say a lot of the things contextually and culturally that she was saying. A lot of people didn't like the things she was saying, but she said them nonetheless.
And the other thing that struck me, Martha, in terms of that cultural reference to Mandinka within that, but there's another essay, and it's here, and more than the one I'm going to talk about, but Open Letters to a Spiritual Soldier, I Want Your Hands on Me, is the song that Parakista Kakpur has chosen. I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly. But this is a kind of a cross-cultural thing that Parakista turns up, picks up on regarding Sinead O'Connor.
Where she's crossing over into sort of into the world of rap.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, where she, because yeah. MC Light is part of that song, isn't he? I Want Your Hands on. Yeah, she talks about Parakista talks about she had moved from Iran to California and she found some kind of affinity within that.
Right, and she writes in the essay, she says, "Dear Sinead, who would believe a white Irish girl could introduce me to a black rapper from Brooklyn?"
Exactly.
Like, yeah. So it really is about the sort of the ability of Sinead's music and her own kind of musical magpie-ism to, you know, given what Sinead Gleason just said about sort of, you know, maybe not being completely aware of what might be appropriative. At the same time, she was really, really had a explorer's soul musically, right? And she was working across a lot of different genres. And I Want Your Hands on Me was just a really early example of that I think Parakista really gets at beautifully in her piece.
The other aspect that I noticed as I played Mandinka, you can play any Sinead O'Connor song and you will notice her voice, obviously. But those leaps from kind of the low, middle range of her voice up to those incredibly high notes, Sinead Gleason. I mean, she had a voice of phenomenal versatility and ability.
It's such an extraordinary kind of voice. Sinead can do very quiet, or she can do sort of, you know, in something like Troy, it's almost terrifying. It's like this ladder of emotion. And I say in my essay that it had a kind of electricity that only Sinead could conduct. There was extraordinary the things she could do. She could sing songs like that sounded like lullabies, and she could sing songs that sounded like manifestos. So the range is incredible. And you know, you hear the first bar or two of Sinead's voice, and you know immediately it's her. No one has. I never will sound like her. It's just an extraordinary kind of a ne plus ultra voice that doesn't sound like anybody else. And we were so lucky to have it for the time that we did.
Yeah, and indeed, Martha being co-editor of this collection of essays, we do get lots of people commenting in various ways on Sinead O'Connor's voice and the nature of that voice, the almost indescribable nature of that voice.
Yeah, I think that, you know, she... At least for me, as a young person growing up, I was about the same age as Sinead O'Connor. And so when I came up in the music scene in the United States, I was coming of age in kind of the alternative underground music world here, which was very, very male dominated at the time. And Sinead O'Connor, to us, I was not paying, you know, that much attention, if any, to the Irish music scene. She came out of nowhere. And just really, it was just a very seismic event for me and myself and my friends, because here's this young woman, our age, looking amazing, sounding like nothing we've ever heard before, and really just modeling this kind of feminine power that we sorely needed as well in the U.S. Mm. I mean, the political conditions here were different, but they weren't great either. We were growing up under Ronald Reagan at the time. So, you know... Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm growing up at that time, and of course the Saturday Night Live event and the tearing of the picture of the Pope comes immediately to mind when you say that, and the power of that mm-hmm. moment. But just going back to the voice, Sinead Gleason, I'm not sure whether it's hard to say your particular phrase, whether it's a bit of French or a bit of Latin. Ne plus ultra, ne plus ultra, which is it? Explain that term to me.
well, nuplu ultra means like no one above it, nothing better. Yeah. And I don't think there is anybody. I mean, I think I think when I think of the female singers that I'm drawn to, they are people who have sort of very unique and distinctive and very not like, like people like Kate Bush, people like Joanna Newsom, people who don't sound like anybody else. And I think that, you know, it's very hard to vocally be different to everybody else and to bring something else to notes and composition. And I think one of the things Sinead can do that I think most singers can't do is channel a very specific kind of emotion. I mean, there are songs of hers that are still very hard for me to listen to because they're just packed full of emotion, whether she's talking about children or babies or war or famine or religion. Yeah. And it's just, they're extraordinary to be able to channel those feelings into the sounds that come out of your mouth. Not everybody can do that, but Sinead could.
And the other thing, which is across several essays, Martha, Sinead Gleeson mentioned earlier on the song Troy, which is Gianfrangelo's essay of Fire and Ash, and Troy is the song that she has chosen to speak about there. And more than one essay speaks to this mother-daughter relationship. Of course, Sinead famously had a difficult relationship with her own mother. That's quite prevalent across the essays, people picking up on that, isn't it?
It really was. There were a couple. That was one of the strongest themes that came through in the piece. And again, we did not direct. We didn't direct people. We did, you know, we tried to get a broad spectrum of sort of approaches to the different material. But that was definitely something that came through a lot. Obviously, it was something that really resonated with a lot of her fans. You know, the mother-daughter wound that never goes away. You know, if you're really struggling with it, it's something that I think a lot of people carry with them for their entire lives.
But you and the other thing that is in here as well is this the mother aspect of things and her relationship with her own children and how they make that those relationships make their way into her songs. She could manage to do that very personal and what some might say is private stuff. She could do that, Sinead Gleeson, in a way that somehow was still respectful to the people involved, it strikes me.
Yeah, I mean, I think Sinead is very much a heart on sleeve kind of artist. And I think that even when you think of some of the songs that she's covered, and there's a wonderful essay in the book about Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, which mentions that kind of mother wound, that even when she, I mean, the most famously of all, Nothing Compares to You. No one ever thinks about the Prince version. It's Sinead monopolized and is synonymous with that song now. And that is, again, the mark of a singer, a person who can contribute something vocally, but contribute something emotionally, which is what she did to other people's songs. And in her own work, again, there was no subject that was not off bounds. And there's a lot of singers who, you know, will keep it light or keep it pop. But I think, you know, the political scene is there. The activist scene is there in so many of the songs. And I think it's very hard to separate, you know, the music and the politics with Sinead because they're so intrinsic as to who she was as a performer.
Just before we let you go, Sinead, you have another essay coming up this time on Radio 1 this Sunday evening at 7:30 p.m. This is for Clay Neely Anlin's new series, A Giant at My Shoulder. Are you allowed to tell us who the giant at your shoulder was or is?
It could have been many and it could have been Sinead. Yeah. But with shows like this, it's always an opportunity to introduce people to someone they might not have heard of. And this is an artist, a Cuban-American artist called Ana Mendieta, who died 40 years ago this year in quite awful circumstances. But before that, made a huge amount of very political performance work and land art work. And she's been a huge influence on my novel Hagstone. I wrote about her in Constellations. But I feel that kind of bodily, divine, feminine, mystical thing is very connected to Sinead O'Connor. So I can see a sort of link between the two of them.
She's been a giant at your shoulder for the purposes of the last 25 minutes conversation. And I'll finish with you, Martha, because you have an essay within this as well, which it refers directly to your own attachment and own, I suppose, how you have used a Sinead O'Connor song within your own life to understand things. The Wolf is Getting Married.
Yeah, I picked this song, which is obviously, it's a later song, it's from 2012. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this song was to get at, because it's a love song, and I don't know whether it's a love song to a romantic partner or a love song to a baby or perhaps a love song to another family member or a child. But the song is so beautifully pure in its expression of what I see as kind of the healing power of love, which is something that is basically what my essay is about, that I thought it was really important to honor Sinead's incredible resilience and her capacity for joy. and love. I mean, you look at her on her tombstone, it says God is love.
Yeah.
So, which I visited a couple days ago when I was still in Ireland. So that's why I picked that song, that I wanted to, she spoke all of these hard truths to so many people, and so many people responded to that in her art, But I also think that she had a lightness to her and a joy that I didn't want to get erased.
Yeah, well, you certainly, I think, across these essays, lightness, joy, and, you know, those hard-hitting points are all within many of the essays that I got a chance to read at any rate. Sinead Gleeson, Martha Bain, thank you so much for being with us this evening. And let's finish up with a little bit of The Wolf is Getting Married. If you have ever wondered what's really going on behind closed doors at the company where you happen to work, then a new production at the Peacock Theatre might give you some insight. The Lunch Power Hour in Conference Room 4 is written by Cortina Daly, directed by Raymond Keane. It will premiere on the Peacock stage of the Abbey Theatre in Dublin at the end of this month. And Katrina and Raymond are both with us in studio this evening. As I was saying, Katrina, I laughed out loud at sections of this. You didn't go for the punchy little title, though.
No. And I think that was the first title I came up with. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I'll come up with another one eventually. Mm. But it eventually just stuck. So,
but, you know, in some ways, it is the sort of thing that would be on a corporate agenda.
Exactly.
Which if you explain the kind of the essence of this show, which is three people in a boardroom at lunchtime.
Yes, exactly.
What are they doing?
Well, I suppose how much do we say without giving much away?
Enough to give us a sense of the fun that is there.
It's a lunchtime meeting, and they're there to discuss. There's a surplus in the company's CSR budget. So they're there
even
to discuss.
Even CSR, you're in corporate speak already.
Oh, yes. Corporate social responsibility budget. Thank you for pulling me up on that, John. So there's 10 grand that they have to donate to a cause. So they have a way of conducting this meeting that is a little bit strange and alarming and intriguing, I suppose. Yeah.
So we have Clodagh,
Daniel, and the receptionist, formerly known as Jess. Yes.
That is my favourite name. Again, not punchy, but nevertheless, the receptionist. And every time you see it on the page, it's FKA Jess.
Yes, FKA Jess.
So Clodagh, where is she at in her career, or what does she want in her career?
Yeah, so Clodagh is an executive assistant to the managing director of the company. So she describes herself as the brain and the life's blood of the company. She signals where everything's
to go. I bet
you
the managing director doesn't describe her as
sure,
that.
I'm sure he doesn't, but he knows her worth, I'd say, as well.
Yeah.
So she's kind of hoping to leave kind of the operational side of the business. And I think she says, I don't want to help the moneymakers. I want to be a moneymaker.
Yeah, fair enough.
So that's what she's trying to do.
Then Daniel is kind of at a different point in his life, I suppose.
Daniel is a senior associate. He's kind of...
I love these titles.
Yes, he's a senior associate and he's just kind of making his way through life comfortably enough. But he has kind of hidden passions.
And he's made a few mistakes.
He's made more than a few, Sean.
Yeah. He's made a few mistakes. But particularly with his daughter, who's mad into the ga.
With his daughter, who's on the under... She's 9 years old on the under-11s GAA team. So she's a ga star for sure.
And now, the receptionist, formerly known as Jess, I would argue could be... the writer, formerly known as the receptionist.
Well, it's interesting you picked up on that. So Jess is an academic who has taken a job as a receptionist in this company because she would like to get a mortgage with her partner. Yeah. And in order to do that, she has to be meeting certain restrictions placed on her from the bank. So this... I think her idea is that this won't take up too much brain space being a receptionist and I can do my study on the side.
I guess somebody who would be writing might have to do something like
somebody
that.
Somebody who is writing may have to do that as well. I mean, what can I say?
You're obviously not the receptionist, formerly known as Jess, but you have been in those boardrooms.
I've been in those situations.
At lunchtime, you used to go into the boardroom just to eat your lunch because it was the best place to eat your
lunch. Oh, absolutely. I worked in one place once where there was no facilities at all to eat your lunch. I'm not sure if the tactic was that if people eat at their desks, they're kind of working more, but
they also get the coffee. They also have the coffee moment over the keyboard, and crumbs get stuck in it. Sticky keys.
Yes.
Don't know how I know any of that, but I believe that happens.
Wouldn't be you, Sean. Wouldn't be you.
That happens to some people. Raymond, you know, I was looking at the script. I mean, as Catherine describes, there are very serious points made in this play. There's no question about that. But there's a lot of fun to be had. The number of times in the script that what is there is simply a physical direction or a direction for some physical business. I said, well, of course Raymond Keane is going to be directing this because that is your type of theatre, really, isn't it? And this seems to me fits into that perfectly.
It certainly does, yeah. And it was a joy to be offered it, I must say. And for Katrina to trusting me to do it, yeah, there's lots of business, you know, but we have an incredible bunch of talent that I don't have to do that much work with, you know, because they're...
Who are the three actors that are involved here?
Fionn Foley, Caoimhe O'Malley, Emma Dargan-Reid and the great Helen Norton. We haven't mentioned her.
The fourth character
is HR Lady Susan.
So HR Lady Susan eventually gets to say hello to us, does she?
She does.
She's been kept out, isn't she?
She patrols the corridor trying to figure out what's going on. So I think in ways she's my favourite character because she's very great. Real.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to comment on HR Lady Susan, because I might be brought up in for VHR if I...
You never know.
if I do. On the more serious side, I suppose, Raymond, what was it that struck you? Because, yes, a lot of fun, a lot of physical business in this. I'm just going to say there is wrestling. People can wait and see how that happens. Yes. There is wrestling. Yeah. What were the more serious sides of this script that attracted you?
Well, first of all, let's just keep saying it's a comedy.
Oh, it is. As Katrina lined it out for us, I think there's no doubt there's fun being
and
had.
Don't comedies make great points? Yeah. You know, when they're that good, you know, it really is an extraordinary play. And I'm not just because Katrina's sitting beside me now, but it is an extraordinary play speaking for our times, you know. And, you know, you go with me in this, Katrina, but, you know, the other day I was thinking, it's like modern times in Chaplin without the machines, you know, the invisible force now in the culture we live in today, you know. And, you know, when you don't have agency for your life, you know, how do you survive? And Katrina captures that really beautifully. And, we play a game at least, don't we, to get by. We find devices that would keep us sustained, if you like, you know, and the social responsibility fund surplus, you know, it gives people a little power, but not much power.
Yeah.
So they use it to the best advantage and to deal with life, essentially. But along the way, as, you know, Cronon reveals to us in the end, the managing director, you know,
who's kept off stage, isn't he?
Yeah, he's the invisible force. Mm. You know?
And that's a wonderful performance by Brian Quinn, who we also forgot to mention.
Yeah, so there are off stage elements.
There are
off stage elements within this, and as Raymond outlines there, I think that was part of it. You know, I was joking about CSR, the corporate social fund or whatever. Social responsibility, CSR, is it?
Yeah.
Social responsibility fund. In some ways, I think you're looking at the idea, here we are talking about this and worrying about, you know, is my latte too hot or too cold when there are very serious things happening all around us. I think that's is pretty much in your mind, Katrina.
Yeah, I suppose I wrote the play from a place of the world feels quite dystopic at the moment. I don't think I'm the only one who thinks that. But
you wouldn't be alone in that one.
No. And it's quite bleak and most of us are just stuck at desks, making coffees, making teas, filling in financial reports and all this kind of stuff. And I suppose when I think of the plays of the 20th century surrounding World War II and stuff and all of this kind of civilian resistance and that kind of thing. And I'm like, how do we resist paradise?
Do we make our point? And I suppose writing plays
and that lovely phrase, joy is an act of resistance.
Yeah.
You know?
And comedy can be an act of resistance, which it certainly is
in this play.
And it is a comedy. I will reiterate that for you, Raymond. Katrina Daly and director Raymond Keane, thanks so much for coming in to us this evening. The Lunch Punch Power Hour in Conference Room 4. if you haven't got the memo. It will be on at the Peacock stage of the Abbey Theatre. It previews on the 31st of July, opens on the 6th of August, and then runs through until the 6th of September. And you can find out full details on abbeytheatre.ie. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night at 7. John Creedon will be with you after the news.